This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Earth Matters. I'm Lee Chui Lin. The December UN Climate Change Conference in Paris offers a last chance for a deal that stops global warming reaching risky levels, says UN Climate Chief Cristiana Figueres. But with greenhouse gases projected to rise more than 4 Celsius, can countries even make the necessary cuts? And how will the Paris talks succeed when previous summits have failed to produce concrete plans? Here to answer these questions is France's Ambassador at Large for Climate Change for Asia and Oceania, Philippe Zeller. Philippe, what are the main expectations for the Paris Conference on Climate Change, or COP21, later this year?
Of course, the main expectation is to get a success. It's so important to decide now what we will live during this century and what our children will live. The message of scientists and researchers is very clear. If we don't act, the average temperature of the globe will rise to a level of +4 to +5 degrees Celsius. And when you know that there are only 6 degrees Celsius of difference between the time where we had the last ice age in the world and today, you can understand how important it is to act now due to the climate disruption and not only global warming we are already facing. So it's absolutely important to get the success. For many reasons, it should be possible because it was prepared during the last years, let's say. But it's also extremely important to have a global consensus because we don't have to forget that it's a UN negotiation, which means that as UN works by consensus. So every of the 195 countries or even 196 parties, because we include the European Union in itself, have to be okay at the end of the negotiation, saying, yes, I am okay on this draft text to reach the consensus. And so that's also a condition of reaching that consensus to be a success. Yeah.
There are going to be 4 main pillars in the talks: mitigation, adaptation, technology, and transparency. Could you tell us briefly why each pillar is so important?
In these negotiations, actually, we have to go back to 1992, which was the year when the Rio conference occurred and was organized, and the date, the year when the Convention of Rio on Climate Change was adopted. And already at that time, we consider that there was difference between the mitigation, which is facing the fact that the world produces a lot of greenhouse gases and we have to reduce it because we know that we have only before us probably 25 to 30 years still to produce greenhouse gases. And adaptation, which in a way is the consequence we have already to face, many countries have to face on the outfalls of the climate change and global warming. But there are also other concepts used, as you just mentioned. Transparency is a fact that, as in a classroom, every pupil has to deliver its proper work on how to face and to try to have a better solution for combating climate change. But it's very important that the other pupils know about the fact that you are preparing your proper contribution. Financing is also extremely important because we will not shift from the fossil fuel society we have now to a low-carbon and low-carbon energy society without financing these transformation, these shifting. And there are other ideas, but the main ones are just exactly the ones you just mentioned. And that's some wording not only expressing facts or challenges, but also wordings which were adopted during the last 20 years, let's say, among all the negotiators, because it's now very clear. And that's also a reason why we have to decide now in Paris, because all is on the table. All the concepts are on the table. All the challenges are on the table. But now how to agglomerate them, how to deal, how to manage them, it's the main challenge, clearly.
What is France specifically doing to ensure that there is measurable progress on combating climate change?
First of all, it's not only France. France will chair the COP, but again, that's a UN involvement. But second, we have to take into consideration all the messages we get from different countries throughout the world, the small islands, or the oil producers, countries which are very vulnerable, like Southeast Asian countries. Let's think of floods, typhoons, and so on and so on. And others which are not so vulnerable, but could become vulnerable. So for us, as a chair, we have to take into account all these positions and really hoping, and that's our target, that all these positions will be managed all together, but to reach the message given by the scientists, which is we have to cap the average global temperature to a level of plus 2 degrees Celsius and no more. And that's very important to be sure, and that's our duty, our task of the French chairmanship, that every country, every negotiator is aware of the fact that we have to reach these level of keeping the temperature with all the measures we have to include into the draft text to be sure that after Paris is not an end in itself, Paris is a beginning, that national policies will be implied, will be involved for reaching this common target. In that way, it's also very important to have in Paris a long-term engagement, a long-term goal, and that's still to be defined. Will it be 230? Not sufficient. Will it be 250? It begins to be very important. Will it be the end of the century? It should be probably the end of the century. But having a long-term goal, and you can imagine the difficulty of trying to define a long-term goal when we are around 200 parties and discussing with so many different types of economy, population, and so on.
With that said, why is Paris letting countries decide how much they want to cut their emissions by?
Well, the new thing, which is very interesting, for the first time, every country has to deliver before Paris, actually, so now in the next weeks, if not already done, 45 countries already done that.
Have top done of that. The class.
And that's very interesting to see that among the 45, on one side you have the USA, you have China, you have the European country. But on the other side, you have a country like Marshall Islands, this small archipelago in Northern Pacific, which already delivered its program, its work. So it's very important to have all these contributions being known before the opening of the COP itself, because during the very few weeks before the opening of the COP, experts, and some of them coming from the World Bank or some others from OECD, for instance, will make a global amount of all the contributions and saying, well, there are some things very interesting in such an or such contribution. Could it be by capping the emissions, by introducing renewable energies, by adapting, and so on and so on? But the amount of all these efforts is insufficient compared to the efforts we have to do, hearing the scientists saying, yes, no more, not more than 2 degrees Celsius. And this gap is something which is, in a way, a political thing, a political challenge, and very important to know it before the COP. So the reason why we are just advocating for getting all these famous national determined contributions before the opening of the COP. But we are rather optimistic because you see already one quarter of them are already on the table. And many countries, and it's the case for Malaysia, for instance, are very clear they will release their national determined contribution before the end of October.
What can be done to ensure that countries don't backtrack on these pledges? I mean, when we're talking about transparency, of course, this is a major part of that. After you've made a pledge, a pledge is a pledge. You know, how do you ensure that it's held?
Yeah, you are entirely right. And that's something which is at stake during the negotiation, the pre-negotiation, and will be clearly discussed in Paris, but is already discussed actually in what we call the intersessional meetings for preparing the COP. Because the question is, yes, you can deliver your copy, but how to assess it immediately and then after that? And of course, life is life, economy is life, business is economy, business is business, science is science. We will have to assess them, let's say every 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, that's to be discussed. How to assess them? Will it be an assessment by the countries themselves, just delivering a new copy? Will it be viewed by a survey or by a group of experts saying, yes, that's interesting, but not sufficient? And there's a kind of backsliding, as the negotiators say. It's absolutely open, and what the experts call that, the MRV measures, let's say, how to review regularly. But it will be very important. It's probably not necessary to have a yearly review or even every 2 years, but at least to have something like every 5 years will be absolutely useful, which means at least twice till 2030. That will be a first important step and a very positive step.
I'm speaking today with Philippe Zeller, France's Ambassador at Large for Climate Change for Asia and Oceania. We're discussing France's role in this year's Climate Change Conference. Up next, we look at the gulf that exists between developing and developed nations. In these discussions, you're listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You're listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me today, Philippe Zeller, France's Ambassador at Large for Climate Change in Asia and Oceania. We're discussing this year's Climate Change Conference that's happening in Paris in December, or COP21 as it's otherwise known. So how will France make sure that this year's talks aren't a repeat of the disastrous Copenhagen Conference in 2009, which nearly derailed the global climate change fight?
Can we speak of a disaster in Copenhagen? In a way, yes, but not only. Because, not to enter some technical details, but at least there was already the consciousness that we have all to act and that we have to act very, very soon. But clearly, at the end of the conference itself, it was very difficult, and we don't want to duplicate or replicate the way this conference was organized at that time, which, by the way, means how to imply the leaders, the political leaders, the heads of state and heads of government. Which is very important. Paris will be a success if we succeed on four pillars. The first one is to get an agreement, a legally binding agreement under the umbrella of the UN. But legally binding, meaning every country has an engagement towards all the other countries in the spirit of the United Nations. And it's very interesting to see that to determine the future of the planet is still the duty of the United Nations. The second pillar is to collect all these contributions we spoke about, and to be sure that all the technical data will be on the table to collect them globally and to have a global amount of them. The third pillar will be financing, clearly, how to organize and to channel the flows of money we which means the economies throughout the world, not only the economies of developed countries, of emerging countries, but of all the countries, will need to mitigate and to adapt. And the fourth pillar, which is the most probably optimistic of them, is to showcase all the measures already taken not only on science, based on science, but also based on technology, which means also transfer into technology, taken, for instance, by the networks of local authorities, cities, NGOs, and so on, citizens, and so on, and so on. So we hope to get an agreement on all these four parts, of course, and clearly financing is one of the main challenges, as you can imagine it.
What is the expected outcome from Paris on finance and technology while we're discussing finance?
Copenhagen, precisely. That's the reason why it was not absolutely entirely difficult in Copenhagen. There were some positive steps taken. In Copenhagen, the decision was taken to say, beginning 2020, we should have, and we ought to have a yearly flow of $100 billion channeled from developed countries, or at least, let's say, the former Kyoto Protocol members, to the emerging economies and to all what we called the let's say developing countries, although you have today to make many differences among the developing countries. So to have a channel every year this amount of $100 billion. That's a political decision being taken and repeated. For instance, it was repeated in during the G7 meeting in Germany two months ago. For having that, you have first to assess what it's already done. And many things are already done concerning financing, clearly through development, through aid. It's not only a question of regreening the flows already used for development and aid, but in a way it's also the case because there is no gap between combating climate disruption and helping the development of countries. But we will probably have to consider that we have to add some new money. And in a way, in Paris, that will be one of the challenges. That's the reason why we, France, organized during the last months many meetings for preparing these specific parts of the negotiation, meetings of world banks, of regional banks, public banks, but also private banks, even insurance companies, because insurance is also at stake concerning climate facing climate change. And we are just working hard with companies and networks of companies, and specifically oil producers, because they are just in the center of the challenge, clearly.
You talked earlier a little bit about developing and developed nations, and that's something that's come up time and time again when we're talking about these discussions. What do you say to claims that developing countries are promising to do more to cut emissions than rich industrial nations?
You mean to developing countries?
Yes. Yeah. To the claims that developing countries are promising to do more compared to, developed, quote-unquote, developed nations.
The figures are very interesting. 20 years ago, it was clear that a country like China didn't represent a quarter of the greenhouse gas emissions, as it's the case now. And other emerging economies and countries like India, Brazil, South Africa, and so on, are also now very important players of the game, if it's a game. It's not only a question of public aid, public development. It's also a question of a new way of understanding the economy, so the business. You have some people saying if we really are able to shift towards this low-carbon economy throughout the world, it will create a lot, millions of new jobs. So some people say 60 million of new jobs will be created. And where will the new jobs created? Probably, essentially, in the emerging countries or in the countries evolving very, very fast. It's the case of Malaysia. So it's not only a question of channeling only cash money that will be necessary, at least for helping countries to adapt. If you take the example of a country like Bangladesh, with probably one-third of the population being hit by the rising of sea level, they will have to adapt and to create new and to manage these migration. But it's also a question of rapidly, swiftly introducing new technologies. And for that, you don't necessarily need a lot of money. If you take, for example, the question of adapting the housing, the way that we organize the flows of temperature into the housing new project. It's not only a question of cash, of money, but also of managing, introducing new technologies, which could not mean a global amount of, a huge amount of money, but also accepting to transfer technologies. So the challenge is not only to think in terms of finance, but also to think in terms of transferring technology, and that's another challenge, clearly.
How will the Paris deal in turn take care of poorer and vulnerable developing countries that are already suffering the impacts of climate change? I mean, we can look towards the future, but of course, at present, we also have a situation where, as you point out, with rising sea levels, certain countries are suffering more than others.
Absolutely, you are entirely right. And that's a message delivered by many of them and the famous OASIS countries, like the 14 Pacific Islands countries or other countries like the Maldives and so on. And we have, first of all, to hear their message. They say 2 degrees Celsius plus 2 degrees Celsius is already dangerous for us. So they would prefer to deal with only plus 1.5 degrees Celsius. It's still on the table. Could be that in Paris there will be some declaration of the fact that even 2 degrees Celsius is too high and would be preferably, because that will be a way to recognize that it's a question of survival for them. Second, we have to adapt also our tools, financial tools. That's one of the aims of the new Green Fund headquarters in South Korea, in Seoul, which will be dedicated exactly to, as soon as possible, beginning this year, and actually with some examples even adopted before the COP21, to deliver and to face projects directly allowing this country to adapt to the new situation by helping them to create some dams for preventing the rising of the sea level, for instance. That's the reason why also it's a question of national policies. For instance, we, France, decided that our aid policy on a bilateral way, but that's the same for European Union policy, is now dedicated and mostly oriented to combat or to help countries to adapt to the new situation. And specifically in this region, we have a tool called the French Development Agency, and now 60% of the flows of capital and cash money are directed to help countries to adapt.
Looking from developing countries to the big players, we often hear that China is the world's largest polluter, but in historical terms, it is a much smaller contributor to global warming than the United States, and it is, of course, far more populous. What are you expecting from China and Paris, and how can it contribute to a successful outcome?
The last news we got from China are positive for many different reasons. China is aware of his weight now in the global economy. Again, 25% of the global emissions are emitted from China now. It's very important for China to participate to this shifting to a low carbon economy. But there's also the public opinion, Chinese public opinion. We all know the role of pollution during the last years in big Chinese cities. So China will play a very important role in Paris. There are already very interesting common joint declarations released, and we have in mind, of course, the Chinese-American declaration. We are just now preparing other declarations like this one, and which will be adopted before the COP. China released its national determined contribution 2 or 3 weeks ago, which was in a way an example and a sign given by the Chinese authorities. What's at stake for China is a question of what we call the peak of the emissions. Will it be before 2030? That will be a very optimistic way of seeing the things. Will it be after? It will be a little difficult to accept this idea. But we are optimistic concerning China. Probably there will be an official visit of my President Hollande before the COP to China to underline. But it's not only a question of China. If we take the example of the Asian countries in Asia, we have to have in mind the role of India, because even if its emissions are not exactly at the same level, it's just under 10%. India is now really committed to introduce, for instance, solar energy. The cities in India are really facing challenges, but are happy to and ready to face them. Research in India is also extremely important. And if we take the example of the ASEAN countries altogether, the 10 ASEAN countries represent more than 8-point-something% of the global emissions throughout the world. If you take into account the fact that for EU it's less now than 10%, in a way we are comparable, the level of emissions. And that's also the reason why we are just looking at what happens between ASEAN countries. And there was, for instance, 2 weeks ago in Bangkok, a meeting between EU and ASEAN dedicated to climate change and opening the way and paving the way to a common declaration, which will be released probably in October, next October, so before the COP, and underlining the opportunity of cooperating between ASEAN and EU on new technologies, but also helping both parts of this world to adapt and to face the disruption.
Looking at a country that is in neither ASEAN nor in EU, how do you respond to the claim that international climate rules are being weakened to accommodate the United States?
The position of the United States is considered as positive, proactive, under the leadership of President Obama, who seems to us absolutely transparent of these aspects of the things. We have also to take into account what the U.S. colleagues and delegates explained very clearly. It's not only the decision of the executive, which means the president, the presidential administration. It's only the question of having a positive decision of the parliament, which means the Congress, of course, which is absolutely important, because we will succeed on climate change if there is a global agreement, not only of the negotiators, but also on the people, and clearly through the parliamentary representation. So the question you just raised is the question of finding the way of having a final text been accepted not only by the U.S. executive, which normally should be, I wouldn't say easy, but
simple.
Simple, yeah. But also which we would be, will be, or would be agreed by the Congress. That's something which is difficult to take into account, but we work very hard with our American colleagues to know how to manage this question. And a part of that, clearly, USA Now, the same for the U.S. public opinion, is very well aware. And although it's also a major oil producer, they know exactly what's at stake here.
Will the agreement from Paris be weaker than the Kyoto Protocol for the developed nations?
Oh, no, absolutely no. The Kyoto Protocol, it was only a question of diminishing. For instance, for the period 2010 to 2014, I think, yeah, only something like minus 5% or something like this. No, a Paris Agreement will be a clear involvement of developed countries, or let's speak of G7, OECD countries, and that's reflected by the decision taken by the EU itself to diminish the emissions with a level of 40% between 1990 and 2030. If you include the economic growth during that period, you understand that's a real engagement and deep engagement for reducing. No, Paris Agreement should be very a real pressure, I would say, on developed countries.
We've talked a little bit about oil. Will the Paris outcome also include concrete results on renewable energy, clean energy?
This question is exactly the question of what we include in the agreement itself. It's difficult to include some wording saying you have to reach a part of the energy mix of, let's say, 10%, 20%, 30% of renewable energy before 2020 or 2030. It's up to each country to decide the way they will develop renewable. But of course, there will be main ideas for favoriting the development of renewable energy. There are many questions around that. Taxation, of course, of fossil fuel energies and so on. But also how to channel the financing towards the new technologies, and not only solar or wind renewable or hydroelectricity and so on. You have a lot of solutions, very interesting actually to speak of that with some experts. At the end of the day, that Paris has to create a global agreement saying we have all together to reach this common target. After that, it's like in a classroom, the teacher says, I want you to reach this level of knowledge. But you are absolutely free to use different tools you can use for reaching this agreement. And that's very interesting because it's a question not only of science, of the future of humanity, it's also a new way of organizing diplomacy among the countries. It's the first occasion for all the countries of the world to engage themselves towards the other partners. And that will be applied to renewable energies very clearly.
Thank you very much for your time, Philippe. I've been speaking with Philippe Zeller, France's Ambassador at Large for Climate Change for Asia and Oceania. We've been discussing this year's climate change conference that's happening in December in Paris, France's role in it, as well as what the expected outcome can be. You've been listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.